If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to check out another new podcast from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's called The Televisionaries. Each week, our most esteemed critics talk about the best and worst shows on TV right now. They'll tackle the big question affecting the industry and find a gem in the back catalogue. So if you can't decide what to watch, let the experts do it for you, because no one knows TV like The Televisionaries. From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we're looking at the clitoris. Well, that and a woman named Helen O'Connell. Good Weekend senior writer Melissa Fyfe met Professor O'Connell for an award-winning December 2018 story about this Melbourne doctor who first mapped the clitoris. Today, Mel will join Good Weekend editor Katrina Strickland, as well as occupational therapist and vulva puppet owner Anita Brown Major, to delve deep into the G-spot. But first, actor Sarah Bishop will read the story in full. So take a walk or put the kettle on and enjoy Get Clitorate, How a Melbourne Doctor is Redefining Female Sexuality.
You can trace Professor Helen O'Connell's discovery of the full clitoris and the rewriting of the world's anatomy texts to two books, one that angered her and another that inspired. The first book, Last Anatomy, she couldn't seem to escape. The 1985 edition was the set text for her surgical exam, and to her utter disbelief, as a classic overachiever, she failed the test three times. She calls this the ridiculous book. It had almost no mention of the clitoris and certainly no illustrations, yet there were two pages on the penis. To top it off, aspects of female genitals were described as a failure of male genital formation. O'Connell still has the book, the word failure underlined in blue pen. "I knew at some point," she says, "that I was going to have to tackle that." She came across the second book a few months after finally passing her surgical exam in 1989. It was called A New View of a Woman's Body and was published by the US Federation of Feminist Women's Health Centres. It's full of detailed drawings of vulvas. For the clitoris chapter, the female researchers took off their pants and compared themselves with illustrations in respected anatomy texts. Then they masturbated, observed each other, and took notes of the many parts of the internal and external clitoris that were changed by or contributed to sexual pleasure or orgasm. Young Helen O'Connell, age 27, found it really cool, and the women's observations, though not scientific, valid. When she first tells me about this book in her consulting rooms in the Royal Melbourne Hospital's private wing, it's obvious she's still fascinated by these women and the way they watched and mapped each other's sexual responses. "Amazing methodology," she laughs. "Don't you think? Just amazing." In the book, the researchers said they had no access to dead bodies or dissection rooms, so they had to partially rely on old anatomy texts. And that was a light bulb moment for O'Connell. She had access to dead bodies and dissection rooms at the University of Melbourne, where she was studying her Masters of Medicine in Women's Health. "We just needed to do good science and work it out from the cadavers," she says. And that really is how Helen O'Connell came to change the world of female anatomy forever. I find myself sitting in O'Connell's office because, rather strangely, of Netflix. A few months ago, I was watching a series called Explained, a show that packages the modern world into snappy 15 to 20 minute documentaries. On this particular night, the episode to load on my television was on the female orgasm. Around the 8 minute mark, the narrator said that in 1998, the Australian urologist Helen O'Connell and her team discovered that the clitoris was way more powerful than we'd known. I sat up straight. A memory came flashing back to me. It was 1998, and I was a young journalist at The Age, reading the day's news list. O'Connell had found that modern medical science was mistaken about the clitoris. The small button, or glands, that you can see is just the tip of the iceberg. Under the pubic bone, the organ looks like a wishbone with a body up to 4 centimetres long. Coming out of the body are legs, or cura, up to 9 centimetres long, and also eggplant-shaped bulbs up to 7 centimetres long. All these bits, O'Connell confirmed, are sensitive areas made of spongy tissue and become erect, just like the penis. A Melbourne doctor rewriting the anatomy books? This yarn, I thought, was a guaranteed front pager. But when I picked up the paper the next day, the lead front page story was about a parasite that had shut down Sydney's water supply. Victorian Premier Jeff Kennett was calling for states to have the power to veto potential hikes in the incoming GST, and visiting US Secretary of State Madeleine Albright had urged action on climate change. The clitoris story ended up on page 6, squeezed between the paper's fold and a story about an American donation of wheat to Indonesia. Even in this, its moment of glory, the clitoris was treated as it had ever been, downgraded and difficult to find. Sitting on my couch watching Netflix, it was O'Connell who fascinated me. It's been 20 years since that groundbreaking scientific paper. Where was she now? What new mysteries of female sexuality had she solved? Had someone given this woman an Order of Australia? O'Connell's discovery was important for practical reasons. It gave surgeons a map of the key nerves, blood vessels, and connecting parts of the clitoris so that they could try to avoid destroying sexual sensitivity during any pelvic area operation. O'Connell had witnessed many penis-related surgeries where great care was taken to avoid any loss of sexual function. But no one knew enough about the female anatomy to do the same for women. Her work also inspired a generation of sex educators, therapists, artists, and academics who use her research to answer some fundamental and persistent questions about sex. The clitoral versus vaginal orgasm debate. The orgasm gap between heterosexual women and their male partners. Small penises and loose vaginas. The so-called G-spot. All these things sex therapists and researchers say could be better understood if men and women knew more about the clitoris and therefore female arousal. British writer Jessica Behrens once said that without a proper map of the female bits, it's as if everyone's been driving around for ages and still not find where they want to go. A bit like Canberra. It's been 20 years since we've had a proper map. But are we, I wondered, there yet? I'm only 3 minutes late to meet O'Connell, but her medical secretary is phoning, checking my whereabouts. Every single minute is crucial to O'Connell, because being a clitoris guru is just a sideline. Australia's first female urologist, O'Connell is a surgeon who treats patients with lower urinary tract problems, such as incontinence and obstruction. A gifted endoscopic surgeon, she fixes or removes things within the tiny spaces of the urinary tract using a small telescope. She's also director of surgery and head of urology at Western Health, a sprawling health network servicing 900,000 people in Melbourne's west. In her rather limited spare time, and for no payment, she chips away on her female anatomy research, publishing a paper only last year on her search for the elusive but famous G-spot. More on that later. When I get up to the third floor consulting rooms, O'Connell, assured and professional, welcomes me into her office. She's wearing a dark pantsuit and cat's eye maroon glasses, blonde hair to her shoulders, We start awkwardly. I thought the meeting was to merely discuss the prospect of a profile, but she's like, I've got 1 hour now. Begin. In one of her research papers, which with a tangle of keys she unlocks from a white cupboard, O'Connell details the history of the clitoris in anatomy. In the 16th century, Italian anatomist Rialdo Colombo, who called it a seat of lust, and his contemporary Gabriel Fallopio, he of fallopian tubes fame, feuded over who found the clitoris first. Dutch anatomist Reinier de Graaf did a comprehensive job of describing it in the 17th century, even discussing the crucial clitoral bulbs. And in the 1840s, German anatomist George Kobelt published an extensive account of the female genitals, their spongy tissues, muscles, nerves, and blood supply. His black ink drawings are like a landscape of rivers, lakes, and tree roots. Really beautiful, notes O'Connell, who says she simply used modern science to confirm much of his work. But unlike O'Connell, Kobelt failed to connect all the internal bits as one structure, the clitoris, fed by the one nerve complex and blood supply. His work also left unexamined the relationship between the urethra, vagina, and clitoris. Kobelt was soon forgotten anyway, as the clitoris fell out of fashion. That was the fault of Sigmund Freud, the bearded father of psychoanalysis, who declared in the early 1900s that clitoral orgasms were immature and vaginal orgasms mature. In 1948, the 25th edition of the seminal Gray's Anatomy removed the clitoris completely. While the clitoris made a comeback in later editions, only the part you can see, the glands, was noted. O'Connell and her team took 10 cadavers and removed the pubic bone to expose the internal clitoris. They photographed what they saw and did laboratory tests on the tissues. At the time, anatomy texts often failed to mention the clitoral bulbs, which became engorged when aroused. Sometimes they were drawn half their size or put in the wrong place and were named bulbs of the vestibule. A vestibule is a lobby or entrance hall, presumably to the vagina itself. What the hell is the vestibule? Asks O'Connell. And we laugh, giving me the first glimpse of a lovely sense of humour behind the serious facade. Anatomy books also connected the bulbs to the inner parts of the vulva. But O'Connell found this to be incorrect. They were joined to the clitoris body. Meanwhile, there was a whole bit of anatomy, the Bartholin's glands, that O'Connell couldn't find. They simply weren't where the anatomy books said. The standard texts also showed the clitoris flat against the pubic bone. But in reality, O'Connell found, it exists in three planes, with bits going everywhere. The 1995 edition of Gray's Anatomy said the clitoris's major nerve supply was very small. But the nerves were actually noticeably large, greater than 2 millimetres in width. O'Connell was blown away when she discovered how large they were. There's a lot going on in those nerves, she says with a smile. In 2005, O'Connell confirmed her original research with MRIs of 10 living women. See just how amazingly bright it is, she says. It's because of the high blood flow. I'm holding this scientific paper and O'Connell is looking over my shoulder at a black and white scan of a healthy, non-aroused pelvic area. The clitoris stands out from the surrounding tissue in a white glow. She tells me she saw a patient's MRI today, a woman who was probably quite distressed, and there was little blood flow in that area. It's as if there's no clitoris there. I've not tested this, but the tissue is probably very sensitive to stress levels. O'Connell returns to her chair, leaving me with 4 papers to read later. I'm quite keen to read the one about the G-spot, but when I get home, I realise it's missing from the pile. New York artist Sophia Wallace is talking to me via Skype from her white-walled Brooklyn studio. When she picks up her laptop and shows me around it, I see a giant golden clitoris sculpture on a plinth. It's stylized, a little abstracted, but based on O'Connell's correct anatomy. The shadow it makes is sort of like a penguin, she says, when I ask her to describe the shape. It's like the inside of a very complex flower, maybe an orchid, but it's also robust and strong. Since 2012, through her Clitracy project and a popular TED Talk, Wallace has been evangelical about the true shape of the clitoris. She's written a human dwarfing giant wall of words called The 100 Natural Laws of Clitoracy, a sort of declaration of rights for the clitoris. Don't scoff. Each year, an estimated 3 million young girls are at risk of having their external clitoris cut off, according to the World Health Organization. One of the first laws Wallace wrote was a definition, which she holds up to me, big black letters on white card. And there, as part of that definition, is Helen O'Connell, the discoverer of the precise anatomy, function, complexity, and external and internal scale of the clitoris. Wallace despairs that 20 years after O'Connell's research, the taboo around the clitoris persists, and its true form remains unfamiliar. The Oxford dictionaries still describe it as a small, sensitive, erectile part of the female genitals at the interior end of the vulva. I have to deal with censorship all the time, says Wallace. Her web host hides pages and sections of her website, where you can buy an anatomically correct clitoris pendant, or, for that special man in your life, clitlink cufflinks. Facebook and Instagram take down some posts. I think we've come about 5% of the way, says Wallace, when I ask her how clitorate society is now. I continue to see these studies on what percentage of women orgasm through penetration or intercourse, and I'm like, who cares? How many are giving pleasure and not getting pleasure? What are their barriers to pleasure? What is the clit's happy state? What does it have a right to expect? What is a good life for a clit? The sex education of young Helen O'Connell did not start well. The nuns at her Catholic girls' school told the 10-year-old to go home and ask her mother about sex. And so, Mary O'Connell, who was deeply Catholic, took her daughter into the backyard of their middle-class home in Preston in Melbourne's north. They stopped near the incinerator. It was possibly the ugliest part of the backyard, remembers O'Connell. The man plants a seed in the woman, Mrs. O'Connell told her confused daughter. I had no idea what she was talking about, says O'Connell. And Mum was just devastated with embarrassment about the whole thing. From that moment on, all further questions were directed to her older sisters. O'Connell is the youngest of five, with three sisters, including twins, and a brother. Her father, Kelvin, a public servant who worked in civil aviation, was sort of a feminist, says O'Connell. He never ever indicated that you should not do something because you were female. Unusually for her era, Mary worked full-time as a bookkeeper by the time Helen was five. O'Connell remembers watching the moon landing in 1969 at school with a small group of kids whose mothers worked while the other kids went home. She would say a woman's place is in the home, but she was in the workplace, so I'm not sure how that worked. I think she thought she was expected to say that, O'Connell says. But we all knew that Mum was happiest when she was working. This was true for O'Connell also when it came to having kids of her own. With her first child, a son who is now 21, O'Connell had 3 weeks at home in a blissful state, but felt very strange at a profound personal level, an existential level. So she went back to her private practice, at first doing one session with patients a week. I felt I knew who I was again, so the next week I did 2 sessions. With her second child, a daughter who is now 20, she went back after 2 weeks. It felt very strange to be full-time at home with healthy, perfect babies. I trained for 15 years to be a surgeon, and none of that taught me how to be a mother. She pulled off being a top surgeon and a mother with help, help, help. Great husband help, office help, nannies. O'Connell also now has 2 adult stepchildren, but we'll go into no more details about her private life. At high school, O'Connell was popular. My main memory as we walked through school, says Susan Barnes, one of O'Connell's best schoolmates, is of everyone saying, "Hi, Helen! Hi, Helen!" She knew everyone, was school captain, and she had this personality that attracted people. She loved to party, and in medical school was one of the lead singers in a rock band called Unfinished Business. She married the lead guitarist. O'Connell had her heart set on being a surgeon, partly because her mother said she had good hands and that she must do something with them one day. And when she was 2, she was operated on to fix a squint, which planted the idea that surgery could transform and cure. But why urology, which is essentially about what goes wrong in the wee department? She thought it had a great future. A senior surgeon had advised against general surgery. It was dead, he said. Turns out he was wrong. And O'Connell thought the urologists were well trained, and she loved the range of surgery offered, through the urethra, into the bladder, kidney surgery, open abdominal, and perineal. Not everyone thought urology a good career move. Her mentor, Melbourne psychiatrist Lorraine Dennerstein, remembers a surgery interview panel asked O'Connell what sort of man would want to share their urinary problems with her. There were no female urologists in Australia at the time. "Well, we all laughed," says Dennerstein. "What sort of male wouldn't want to see her? She was young and attractive, and some men prefer to share these intimate aspects with a woman doctor. And anyway, many people with urinary problems were actually women. No one thought the women might be uncomfortable going to a male doctor." O'Connell does not remember this, but she does recall a male anaesthetist telling her she'd starve from a lack of work. She said, "I didn't say anything back. I just tucked it away and thought, I'm sure you are wrong." O'Connell did not starve. She had no problem finding patients, male or female. Then in 1998, when the clitoris paper was published, the same year coincidentally that Viagra became available, a whole new world opened up. Her name is barely known in Australia. She's never received an OAM or anything like it, but she's regarded as an international clitoris guru. In 2007, the World Association for Sexual Health awarded her a gold medal, its highest honour. O'Connell never talked about her research to her Orthodox Catholic mother, but just before she died in 1999, Mrs. O'Connell watched an ABC television program about her daughter's discovery. "For all her bizarre stuff with Catholicism," says O'Connell, suddenly crying behind her desk, "she was very proud." Occupational therapist Anita Brown Major admits she might be the world's most embarrassing parent. She has 3 primary school-aged daughters and gets around the inner Melbourne suburb of Brunswick with a vulva puppet in her handbag. What's more, this red and pink satin puppet, which Brown Major uses in her sexual health education work with the disabled, has a fully removable, anatomically correct clitoris based on O'Connell's research. No one knows what the clitoris looks like, even though we had Helen's research so long ago, Brown Major tells me over the phone. She also uses her puppet to train health professionals on basic genital anatomy. You might think health sector workers don't need to meet her satiny friend, but no. Brown Major often gives her classes some plasticine and asks them to construct a model of female erectile tissue. Everyone does a little ball and puts it in the middle of the table, she says. In a recent class, only 2 of the 30 health professionals actually made the correct version. The other day, the Brown Majors had friends over, a family of 4 boys. One of the boys took to drawing a penis and testicles all over the place. I said, "All right, boys, you can draw a dick and balls, but can you draw a clitoris?" It stopped them dead in their tracks. My daughter's Nelly died. We're somewhere in the bowels of Footscray Hospital, the biggest in the Western Health Network. We make seemingly random right-angled turns, sweep into lifts then out, and clip at a brisk pace down grey, windowless corridors. "You can see why Footscray needs an upgrade," says O'Connell. The state government has promised a $1.5 billion replacement. I've managed to squeeze more time out of O'Connell, but plans to follow her around the hospital have gone awry. It wasn't in her diary, and now it's 11 a.m. and she's got a million things to do. She had ward rounds at 7:15 a.m., an educational session for trainees at 8 a.m., and another meeting after that on complex patient problems. She's just had a meeting with someone about the correct sort of needle the hospital should order to inject Botox into the bladder. She's got a meeting soon with a senior doctor about his entitlements. So she can talk now, but only until, she looks at her watch, 11:50 a.m. We come to an office with a nameplate announcing Helen O'Connell, Director of Surgery. Inside is a much more modest workspace than her private consulting rooms, which have views of a boulevard of trees. Here, the vista is the wall of the opposite hospital wing. On her desk is a white mug with a crescent of pink lipstick on its edge. We sit down at a small table near the window. O'Connell, myself, and Western Health's media manager, Paula Wilson. Running the Department of Surgery and Urology Unit of a major metropolitan health network is a long way from where O'Connell began as the only woman practicing urology in Australia. Her first urology meetings were divided into functions for the urologists and a social program for their wives. She remembers in 1991, a lunch function with a bikini parade, which she avoided. She reflects on those days as lonely rather than particularly sexist. She just got on with things. An early mentor introduced her to Dr. Edward Maguire, a hugely influential American urologist who developed key techniques in female urology and bladder science generally. In 1993, O'Connell flew to Houston, Texas to meet Maguire, and he agreed to take her on for a 1-year advanced training fellowship. He taught O'Connell a minimally invasive technique to treat the common problem of stress incontinence, when movement, such as coughing or lifting things, puts pressure on the bladder and it leaks. It involved making a sling of lower abdomen tissue to restore support to the urethra, reducing the size of the surgical cut previously required as well as complications. O'Connell believed this method would become the most popular solution to stress incontinence, but it was soon overtaken by synthetic mesh slings, which were considered even less invasive and easier to recover from. O'Connell was not keen on synthetic mesh. She believed it risky because the body could reject it, so she never used it on her patients. She would not say this herself because she's too humble and worried about the trauma that has been caused, but it turns out she was correct in her judgment. Hundreds of thousands of women with mesh implants are problem-free. But in an unfolding medical debacle, thousands of Australian women have suffered the despair of debilitating pain, persistent infections, and lost sex lives from failed mesh operations. Since 2014, the Australian government has prohibited the use of many mesh products used for surgery for incontinence and pelvic organ prolapse. O'Connell has operated on about 100 women to remove the mesh, and sits on various government and professional committees, trying to get a registry set up to track the quality of care. It is sad the way things have evolved, but these problems need significant government support and cannot be rectified by the professions without it, she said. Anaesthetist Belinda Schramm, who has worked with O'Connell since 2002, says her friend goes the extra mile for her patients. She sees a lot of female patients who have bounced from one specialist to the next, trying to find a solution, and Helen is very committed to them. Schramm says O'Connell is always there for advice and checks in with how everyone is, from the theatre nurses to technicians. She also likes to invite colleagues from the hospital for dinner. Schramm remembers one of O'Connell's dinners for 14 people, which included possibly the largest fish Schramm had ever seen. She comes home from work and cooks like Nigella. Schramm says O'Connell is incredibly focused as a surgeon, but also underneath, a free spirit. One night around 2008, Schramm says they went dancing. Really bad, middle-aged mum dancing. A young theatre technician had promised to take them out, but the venue was unexpectedly awful. We ended up in a laneway where you had to dodge dumpsters to get in. The music was horrendous, probably rave, electronic, completely undanceable. But Helen, this professor of surgery, was out on the dance floor all night, having a fantastic time. Dancing, tennis, and long walks along the Yarra are the release valves of an incredibly driven person. I look at O'Connell's CV, a 32-page scroll of, among other things, accreditations, teaching positions, and professional education. And I wonder what continues to drive her. She went into surgery because her mother said she had good hands, because she could see the transformative power of surgery. But where does the drive come from now, at 56? Sitting next to the window in her Footscray Hospital office, O'Connell struggles to answer at first. I think to help young people develop a better world, she says. And then to everyone's surprise, especially her own, she begins to cry. Why am I so emotional about this? I don't understand. We can come back to this, I say. No, she says. There are so many things young people can do, but to create good science, you create a better future. In what way, I ask? You know, to improve health is just intrinsically good. To improve relationships between men and women is just intrinsically good. O'Connell's voice is breaking up. She is genuinely confused about why she's crying. Wilson, the media manager, has tears in her eyes. It's as if we've all suddenly fallen through a hole into a shaky new paradigm. I suspect O'Connell doesn't spend much time reflecting on her motivation. She later says that navel gazing is pathological. O'Connell thinks, trying to search for a reason for her tears, then gathers herself. Anyway, I didn't ask for any of this stuff, it just fell on me. What does she mean by that, I ask. All the anatomy stuff. It just arrived on my doorstep. I don't often disagree with a profile subject in the middle of an interview, but I point out that actually, she looked at that original anatomy book and knew that one day she'd have to fix it. Yeah, says O'Connell. Yeah. Well, maybe the logical conclusion is just to keep on going. She stands up and reaches for a tissue. 20 years on from her first groundbreaking paper, there's still more work to do. Some further work on the anatomy of the urethra is next. Her work has raised awareness about preserving sexual sensation in pelvic area surgery, but there's plenty of room for improvement. And she's just been appointed the convener for an International Continence Society meeting in Melbourne in 2021. I could have said no, she says. But if you can do something, why not do it? Most people spend all their time trying to get home to watch the television. For what? Really, you know? People run a mile from doing something, and why? What are you here for? It's ridiculous. It's almost a month since I first interviewed O'Connell, and despite several requests, about which I'm starting to feel self-conscious, I still haven't received the G-spot paper. Apparently it was sent, but never arrived in my inbox. And then, finally, I get it. A sexologist called Beverly Whipple popularised the G-spot, named after Ernst Graffenberg, a German gynaecologist who first floated the idea in 1950. It's supposed to be a sensitive part on the stomach side of the vaginal wall, and as recently as 2012, American gynaecological surgeon Adam Ostrensky declared he had found it, calling it a well-delineated sac. His scientific journal article was ranked as one of the most popular of that year. But the G-spot has confounded many who go looking for it, and there's a long-running debate about its existence. American bioethicist Jeffrey Spike has said it belonged in the same category as angels and unicorns. A few years ago, when a journalist asked her whether there was really a G-spot, O'Connell decided she would approach it, as always, scientifically. She and her team dissected the urethra and vaginal wall of 13 cadavers. They reported in a paper published last year that the G-spot does not exist as an anatomic construct. So does that mean there's no such thing as a vaginal orgasm? Essentially, yes, anatomically speaking. But there's a little more complexity. Basically, the vagina itself has no erectile tissue, but any pressure applied can push on the aroused internal clitoris, particularly the bulbs, which are on either side of the lower vaginal wall. So presumably, with intercourse or play, says O'Connell, there will be movement of all that erectile tissue around the vaginal wall. The shape of people's bulbs varies, but there are enough reasons why, for some women, vaginal penetration will be associated with orgasm, particularly given the location of erectile tissue around the opening of the vagina. O'Connell's work echoed that of French gynecologist Odile Boisson and Pierre Foldes. The latter is famous for reconstructing clitorises for victims of female genital mutilation. Using ultrasound, they did various studies looking at the stimulated clitoris and also the clitoris and vaginal penetration. They even did an ultrasound of a couple having sex. The G-spot, they noted in a 2009 paper, could be explained by the richly innervated clitoris. Tanya Cones first came across O'Connell's research 14 years ago when she was studying to become a sexologist. I was like, wow, whoa, how come this wasn't taught in school? Since then, Cones, who regularly appears on radio station Triple J talking about sex, has immersed herself in genital anatomy. It's her basic starting point with the men and women who see her for sex therapy in her practice in Sydney's Surry Hills. She's even got an anatomically correct, 10-centimetre-long 3D model of the clitoris. Helen's work has been really amazing, she says, and I take that theory and wrap it around clinical experience where I see things happening over and over again. In November, Cones was on a sex therapy study intensive, learning and teaching about sexual anatomy. Late at night, after she returned from leading a vulva class, she emailed me the advice she gives clients about making the most of the whole, anatomically correct clitoris. She says while it can take some women very little time to orgasm, the senior sexologists she studied under have timed the full engorgement of the whole clitoris at between 45 and 60 minutes. Tanya says it's totally possible to have intercourse-style sex before that point. But many people are having that kind of sex too early, and it is causing pain and discomfort for a great many folk. She says the clitoris works best with a gentle startup. Don't go straight for the glands and start pressing it like a button, she tells her clients. Start with kissing, touching the outside of the body, and working your way in so that the genitals are getting the idea that they are going to get touched, but you are going to tease us. The clitoral system, she says, can feel nice with pressure on the outside of the vulva, which stimulates the bulbs inside. Pressure can be applied via thumb pads or heel of hand. The clitoral shaft, just above the glands, can feel particularly delicious when a small amount of pressure and movement is applied. She says it's good to understand that with enough arousal, the bulbs swell and push against the wall of the vagina, making it a perfect fit for whatever we put in there, whatever size it is. I get a lot of men going, "My girlfriend's got a flabby vagina and I don't like it." And I say, "Well, maybe you're not doing your job well of warming up your lovely lady. You've got to treat us like a beautiful old vintage car and warm us up in the garage before you take us out for a drive." I always say that if we treated everyone's arousal system as if it is male, which we have done for a long time, there is going to be a lot of bad sex and sex that is tolerated. If we treat everybody as if they had female arousal systems, everybody is going to have good sex all the time. We just need to slow down and let our bodies do their thing. Helen O'Connell is not a sex guru. She is not Bettina Arndt or the eccentric sex therapist played by Barbara Streisand in Meet the Fockers. She just knows about the bits. Talking to her about actual sex is a bit like asking the mechanic about what music you should play in your car. But that doesn't stop me trying, of course. "I get the impression," says O'Connell over a chicken schnitzel and salad, "that sexual health is a lot about free time." I've arm-twisted her into a quick lunch at the Footscray Hospital Cafe, and we're discussing the orgasm gap, a 2014 survey by the Australian Study of Health and Relationships found 66% of heterosexual women reported orgasms at their most recent sexual encounter, compared to 92% of men. International research has put the orgasm rate for lesbians as high as 86%. Women, O'Connell says, still carry the bulk of domestic labour and are not enculturated to chill and relax. We are fed all these images of shopping and perfection and you've got to get your nails done. The myriad things that you have to do now to comply with some idea of acceptable beauty is just unbelievable, she says. And let's face it, men don't have to tick those boxes. They just have to rock up. The barriers for women are just absurd. It takes me until the last phone call with O'Connell to finally ask the question I know I have to ask. It's a mortifying question to ask such a serious person and top-flight surgeon, but here goes. Does it improve one's sex life to be a clitoris guru? "I get what's coming to me," she replies. "That's really tacky though, isn't it? It's probably better not to answer that question, Melissa." But then she tells me about a guy who does research into erectile therapy who injected his penis just before stepping up to the lectern. "That's where you would draw the line," I say. "Yeah," O'Connell says. "That's not me."
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland and I'm the editor of Good Weekend magazine. With me today I have senior writer Melissa Fife and Anita Brown-Major, an occupational therapist specialising in the areas of sexuality and disability. Welcome, Mel and Anita.
Thanks, Katrina. Thank you.
So, Mel, first things first, has anyone given Dr. Helen O'Connell an Australia Day gong yet? And do you still find it extraordinary if not, and can you hazard a guess as to why?
The answer is no, she hasn't been given an award yet. And I was looking at the Australia Day Awards and hoping that she would come up in those. But no, she hasn't yet. I'm hopeful still that later in the year or next year she might get one. I mean, hopefully, you know, the article that we did will begin to change that, but there's probably a long way to go.
Mel, you talk through your article about Dr. O'Connell's paper on the G-spot, and I think one of the things that you discovered is that the G-spot is actually simply part of the clitoris. It's not something different to the clitoris. Tell us about her findings about the G-spot.
So she basically looked at the tissue in that area where people think the G-spot is within the vaginal wall, and she actually analysed whether or not that tissue was in any way different and how it was different. And what she found was that there was no G-spot in the vaginal wall where people said it was, but in fact it was the clitoris that was just behind the vaginal wall, and that anything that pushed on the vaginal wall to an engorged clitoris, you know, was going to be that thing that the people called the G-spot. Am I getting that right, yep, Anita?
Correct. Very much so.
Yep. Anita, maybe we'll get you to come in here. Can you tell us what your research in this area has found in relation to, I guess, when women climax? And over what?
Most of the people I work with, health professionals included, don't know what the clitoris looks like. And yeah, they just don't understand what's it look like or how do you get access to it. But I think when you're looking about climaxing or orgasms actually happen in our brain, and the clitoris is just a really good access to that. So the clitoris has been designed just for pleasure. There's no other reason that we have the clitoris. So the two biggest sex organs in someone's body is their brain and the skin. And so I do a lot of work around with people with disabilities. You know, they might have had a spinal cord injury, and we can still get people to orgasm with the spinal cord injury not accessing the clitoris, but it's just different.
That work was really fascinating. How do you do that?
A lot of my work is actually around education of people with disabilities. And so my sort of work splits into two areas. As an OT, I look at the things you need, want, or have to do in life. And sexuality comes part of that, and intimacy, because it's really intimately connected to quality of life. But most health professionals, you sort of don't want to open the can of worms about sexuality or intimacy. So half my work is actually working directly with clients with disabilities, and that might be acquired later in life, or they may have actually got the disability from birth or from childhood. And a lot of the, when I'm working with adults with from birth or from childhood, a lot of them, they just have never had sex ed, full stop. So it's actually education around what their bodies can and can't do. I think Melissa's article, I've certainly noticed a rise in people understanding what the clitoris is, which is great. So it's been fabulous. But still, you know, you've only probably got 10% of people who come to our courses actually would be able to, you know, tell us what a clitoris looks like, or, you know, where it's positioned, which is pretty dismal. The majority of health professionals don't feel comfortable in talking about sex or intimacy, or if they do feel comfortable, they don't feel like they've got the answers. So a lot of our work is about giving people resources of, you don't need to have all the answers, you just need to know, you know, how to search the internet without crashing your work computer.
Yeah.
and not getting yourself into trouble from that sort of thing. So it's a lot of it is just ways that you can access research.
And how difficult is that work? Is it really hard and painful, or is it joyous because of where you get them to?
Look, I think it's joyous. It's just that it's hard to get people to, I work at a major metropolitan hospital, and I ask the question around sexuality and intimacy to every single patient, no matter what age or gender or relationship status. And I am constantly surprised that it actually increases your rapport with a client, because you've seen them as a human being. Mm-hmm. Most of the people are actually quite chuffed that you can see them as a sexual being.
And so what is the greatest misconception about female sexuality or even sexuality in general, would you say, Anita, out there that you would like, as someone working in the field, to correct?
I think it's about assumptions. I think we need to be curious and not have assumptions. So we as health professionals, like everyone in society, just assume that someone who's 84 and, you know, is a widow is not going to be interested in sex. And that's probably the biggest misconception. The older women are actually more up to talking about sexuality than sometimes the younger population. I do a lot of work around dementia as well. So sexuality is one of the last things to go when someone is dealing with or has a loved one with dementia. We assume that we only need to talk about sex with a young bloke who's married or, you know, is on the prowl sort of stuff. Whereas actually it needs to be throughout the lifespan. And throughout the lifespan, even I think with children, that in terms of education, that kids with disabilities are at huge risk of sexual abuse. We know that through the Royal Commissions. But they're also the ones that have the least amount of sex ed and the least amount of body autonomy. So people, as occupational therapists and physios and doctors, we're touching them all the time. So teaching kids the sense of consent and body autonomy is a lot of what my work is as well. And that concept of that we are in charge of our bodies and we say, you know, what goes on with our bodies. But and, you know, Helen's work is a fabulous concept of being able to have something to touch and feel in terms of education models and to actually go this a refocus on pleasure, really, that we're taught a lot about how to be scared. And, our, you know, girls are particularly taught of how to be scared. But I think there's what's often missing is how do we gain pleasure from our bodies and are allowed to gain pleasure from our bodies.
And we, I think we touched on that, Katrina, in that sex education piece last year about, you know, pleasure and female pleasure just is, was this missing element of sex education in Australian schooling.
Mm. Yeah, and Mel, I think the kids that you spoke to that were high school students, they really felt that strongly, didn't they? That they just didn't get that in their sex education. There was no mention of sex being for pleasure.
That's right. So they're told to not get pregnant and not get a disease, but not actually how to kind of get the best out of their bodies.
And in fact, when you talk, Anita, about assumptions, it takes me to the readers that we got feedback from, Mel. I remember hearing from my grade six teacher who, you know, you would not, she would be in her 80s now, well into her 80s, you would not expect would have been so into this issue, but she just loved your story, which just made me reassess my wrong assumptions. Tell us about some of the reader response you did get, because it was pretty overwhelming, wasn't it?
We actually didn't get a lot of negative responses, which I think we were bracing ourselves for.
Yeah, we were.
But we we were bracing ourselves for this tsunami of outrage, but actually we didn't really get that. We got completely the opposite. But yeah, my favourite was the grandfather, and he said the only time that he gets into his wife's knickers these days was when he put them out on the washing line. But he was so pleased about our story, and he wanted extra copies to give to his grandsons because he thought that he would have benefited from reading it, you know, a long time ago, and that he thought his four grandsons would too. It was very cute.
Yeah. And that brings me to your final question to Dr. O'Connell in the interview, was about whether knowing more about the clitoris leads to a better sex life. And I know we discussed whether you could ask her that or whether that was a bit invasive. She really didn't answer it. But generally, Anita, is that the case? Is knowing more about our organs, our sexual organs, going to lead to a better sex life?
I certainly think it does. Like, I think you can't not. If you understand your body more, then you're in touch with your body more, and then you can actually allow yourself to feel pleasure and direct that. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And Mel, what surprised you about Dr. O'Connell? Tell us about your kind of observations of her and her work life.
I think what surprised me was that she was involved so deeply in this sort of work, like her work has been used in the world of sex, and yet she was just a very sort of straightforward person, who just didn't really want to discuss any of the actual act of sex, but, you know, was very clinical and very incredibly professional and unbelievably bright. She obviously had a really great sense of humour, but it was very hard to access that as a profile subject. She was tricky. She really was tricky, but I think we got there in the end. And particularly, I mean, there was a scene in the story where I just said to her, you know, you've been running a million miles right now, your entire professional life, you're a top flight surgeon, you've done all this amazing research, like, why do you keep going? And she just sort of cried. She burst into tears. And I think that was because actually I don't know how much she's ever reflected. She's not a reflective personality. So she didn't really, has never stopped and thought about it, what she was actually doing. So I think she's a very type A personality, I think, was my impression, which was lovely.
That is also one of the things about journalism and asking questions, isn't it? We do get to ask the questions that people generally don't get asked, those kind of more reflective questions that make people stop and look back. That's one of the kind of benefits of our job, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just did the story about Lynn Burmeister, one of Australia's best IVF doctors. And my first interview with her was in her office, and it was an hour and a half long, I think it was. And her PR person was sitting in the room, who's a very, you know, experienced journalist himself. And we sort of got out of the room, and he just went, "Oh my God, that was so psychological." And it was because you kind of like in that council, like you're wanting to talk about their parents and their how they're being brought up, and for some people who are really busy and ambitious and doing their thing, and that's why we're profiling them, they don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. So it is an interesting thing that we do.
Aki, yeah. You've just made me realise you've now got a trilogy of stories. You've got the Dr. Helen O'Connell piece, you've got the sex education for kids at schools, and now you've got Lynn Burmeister, the IVF doctor. So I hadn't even quite realised we'd turned you into a specialist. And I think we should just point out that Mel's story on Dr. Helen O'Connell won her the feature writing award at the Quills Awards, which is for Victorian journalism, last year, and also won her the Bragg Prize for National Science Writing, which is part of the UNSW. And I think that's probably a good note to end on. Thank you, Mel, and thank you, Anita.
Thanks, Katrina.
Thank you.
Good Weekend Talks is brought to you by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode of Good Weekend Talks was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance by Conrad Marshall. Technical assistance by Cormac Lally, Leah Samaglu and Lap Van. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.